Hey everyone, I'm Frederick Eason, and this is The Alchemy of Money. Today my guest is Lynn Alden. She's a writer of a recently published book, Broken Money, which I reviewed on the Substack. She's also very active on Twitter and writes a very popular newsletter and everything, financial markets, macro. And we talked about money, its history, what it is, thinking about it as a system and as a technology, and how to think about inflation and historical analogs, the 1940s, the 1970s. I just kind of took a deep dive into her world, kind of taking a technological and systems thinking type approach to everything money. All right. I hope you enjoy that. Full disclaimer, of course, none of this is investment advice. But I hope you find some interesting ideas for further thinking and research in this conversation. All right. And with that, let's go. So I want to start off with the book, which I loved, and the framework that you took, which a couple of quotes that stood out to me, which were about the lens of technological developments and sort of the engineering mindset and taking that to financial markets. And I'm really curious about the process of writing the book for you and kind of the premise or the question that you went in with and kind of how it turned out.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I didn't start the book until I had a very firm outline of what the book was going to look like. The way that I've described it is no one should really kind of set out to write a book until they can't not write the book, until it's more distracting not to write it, because there's usually better ROI things you can be doing with your time than writing a book. And so a book, you know, there's a lot of books that's out there that could be articles, you know. And so my view was, don't write a book until there's actually a very strong reason to write a book. And so a number of themes kind of coalesced in my head to approach it. And a couple of the main ones were, you know, the idea of money as a ledger that kind of reconciles the commodity view of money and the credit view of money, and to kind of just kind of unify them into a more streamlined way of thinking about it. And then the other big one was the transmission, the transaction speeds versus settlement speeds and some of the arbitrage that happened. And the broader concept there is the technological lens of money. So a lot of monetary history books will focus on political decisions. You know, they'll go deep into like what this president was thinking or what this central banker was thinking or what was happening here. And those are very interesting historical pieces. But my view is to kind of take a step back and say, well, I mean, the driving force of all of this is technology. There are political decisions that affect, you know, how certain timing works out and how one country gets a leg up over another country, and all that's kind of like local. But in terms of like the global permanent shift of what people use as money is very much a technology focused thing. And so I focus on the technology of money itself. I focus on the technology of banking, how money moves around in the past, the present, the future. And, you know, I think just partly we have to use the strengths we have. And so, you know, I have a background in engineering. It's that blended engineering and finance background. And that's tends to be how I see things. And so I analyze money systems from a systems engineering approach. And I can't help but notice the technological changes that underpin most of our changes. And so I focus a lot on that kind of technological determinism aspect throughout the book.
Yeah, I love that. You make the point at some point that all through history, kind of stronger money displaced weaker money until you kind of hit that point where our currency is kind of completely disconnected from any kind of backing by, I guess, gold at that point. And I love the idea that there were these inevitables. And I think you make that point in the book at some point, is like, however you want to play it out, you think you inevitably always end up at the point where we are today. And I guess the question for me is like, okay, what are actually these inevitables? And if you take them as what they are, like, where do they lead you? And I guess in the book, you end up at possibly Bitcoin or something else that's kind of going back in the direction of hard. But just tell me about, what did you figure out are the kind of laws or inevitable forces that kind of govern the system that we're in?
I think the inevitables were that in this period where ever since we invented the telegraph, we're in like a local maximum. So we can't send gold around very quickly, but we can send information around very quickly. And so we are, for a century and a half now, very reliant on abstract ledgers to move around money. And ledgers tend to consolidate, right? So banks, if you put all your gold in the bank and then they abstract it, the bank now has a lot of control. And if there are a handful of banks in a country, it's very easy for a country to just go to those banks and say, okay, all of this is under our jurisdiction now. Here's your rules on, you know, what you can do with your gold, or, you know, maybe even just you have to give your gold over to us and we will, you know, we'll be a ledger below your ledgers. So these things tend to consolidate. It's hard to enforce things on an individual person level, but it's very easy to enforce things on an institutional level. And when money is in such a technological state that it relies on centralized institutions to move around efficiently, those are then very easy to control. So basically the concentration, the consolidation, the centralization of financial power is what I view as pretty inevitable, at least within that technological frame. Kind of like how prior to that, the inevitable frame was that you would necessarily move up the hardness in terms of money. So you know, there's no world where, you know, cocoa wins as money in a world where gold exists. Anytime gold and cocoa, or gold and shells, or silver and, you know, insert other money, whenever they collide, there are certain ones that are going to win every single time over the long arc of time. And so the first kind of the pre-telecom era was moving up the hardness towards better and better money. And then this telecom era, that the quintessential thing was the consolidation of all of those abstract ledgers. Now, going forward, you know, it's always easier to talk about inevitability in the past than the future,
right?
But the reason it's still valuable is, so there are people that would argue like, hey, if only we had made these decisions, things could turn out differently. And my argument is, that's not the strongest approach to take. If you don't like the system, you can't just advocate for change. You have to build something that makes it change. That's my major view. So it's not, I don't really have a claim about what's going to be inevitable in the future, other than to say it's only going to be better if you can build something that just completely outshines the current system and is robust and can absorb all the attacks from the current system. You can't realistically advocate for the system to change from the inside, because even if we did, even if there's a reset, I would argue that these forces would just coalesce all over again. And so really it's the invention of digital settlement that gives us potentially a new dawn here, you know, potentially a third epoch of, okay, so the first epoch was harder and harder commodity monies. The second epoch was now speed matters, but it can only be done with abstraction. And so these things are going to inherently keep centralizing. And then the third epoch, now that we have Bitcoin and just the, you know, broader concept of digital settlement, the idea that we can have a distributed ledger and we can send bare assets to each other that are not reliant on credit, that potentially opens a new gateway. But of course, going back to the prior point, it's like we have to test to make sure the technology is capable. It has to be able to survive attacks. It has to be able to rebound from attacks. It has to be able to you know, kind of be tested just to be as robust as some of us think it is. And so if it passes those tests, that then becomes the next inevitability. But it's hard ahead of time to say what is inevitable, other than to say you're not going to beat the current system unless you can build something like this that is much better.
Got it. That makes sense. Yeah, I thought of one of the inevitables. Well, not totally the same, but kind of the idea that as soon as you're in the fiat system, the political forces are such that you'll basically face constant debasement in some form. And I guess I grew up in Germany and now I live in the United States, right? And I think both of those you'd call in the book kind of moderately hard money, not hard, but not plagued by the same issues as some emerging markets. And so that's a different life lived and investor experience. Because I think some people around me, like, they'd make the argument, well, okay, do we need to replace the current system? Because it seems to be pretty well. Yes, it leads maybe to centralization, but really there's an incentive to kind of not hoard cash and put the money to work productively. So I guess I'm curious, you've written about systems and kind of whether they're stable, unstable, marginal. And I thought that was interesting. And maybe more broadly, what do investors maybe misunderstand, right? Like I looked at something like Bitcoin, I don't know, is it that important? Do we need something? That the current system seems to be working pretty well. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, what's your take on whether there's the flaws in the current system or not, or also kind of this framework you have for assessing the system. I love that. That stable, unstable, marginal. Yeah, I was like, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so stability analysis comes from control engineering, which is part of my background within systems engineering. I used to build electrical control systems for aircraft simulators. That was my original profession, and then got into engineering management, multiple things like that. But my kind of niche specialty was that control analysis. And so I kind of think of in similar terms when looking at other types of systems, because, you know, electrical system or signal system has its own stability, but so does a monetary system. These, even though it's not out of signals and you know, kind of nuts and bolts, these are human engineered systems. The way that a banking system works and the way the global system works is a rather engineered system. And so in a stable system can operate indefinitely, because whenever things start to get out of whack, eventually resets back to its baseline. Whereas an unstable system, it might have kind of waves of increasing or decreasing stability, but it's accumulating a problem over time that gets worse with each wave. And so eventually it breaks. And so the example I use is that, say, in the Bretton Woods system. So when the United States backed its dollar by gold, and other currencies pegged their currencies to the dollar, you know, a lot of people freak out about 1971 when the system broke. But really, you have to go back before that, because it was designed to be unstable from the start. They backed the dollar by gold, but there's no mechanism to slow down the proliferation of dollars to make sure that they wouldn't grow way more quickly than gold. And so as money supply doubled and tripled, not just domestically, but even offshore fractional reserve banking. So you had fractional reserve banking built on fractional reserve banking. The number of those goes up 2, 3, 4 times. And then more and more entities redeem the dollar for gold until it breaks. It was just inherently unstable design from the start. It was kind of destined to be temporary, even though they didn't really design it with that in mind. In fact, you know, we think of the Bretton Woods system as going from 1944 to 1971, but 1944 was just when it was agreed upon. It wasn't implemented until later in the 40s, and then it wasn't fully implemented until the very late 1950s. That's when all the kind of the that's like when the training wheels were taken off. Basically, that's when all the capital controls and things like that were loosened, and it was actually now a fully functional system. And then it breaks in 12 years, and just U.S. gold reserves go straight down until they kind of run into their minimum amount, and they say, "Okay, we're going to default on the whole thing." It's just completely unstable. The current system's longer lived than that, but there's an instability there as well. So by putting the treasury at the heart of the global financial system, and more broadly the dollar at the heart of the system, the problem is that everybody needs dollars, and so the U.S. has to supply the world with dollars, and the way we do that is by running persistent trade deficits. We basically are in the dollar export business, which at first sounds great. It's like, okay, so we can just give people money and then we get real goods back. But then the question is, what do they do with their dollars? Right. So they don't just hold paper dollars. They reinvest those into the United States. You know, they used to buy our public debt, then they bought our public equities, then they bought our private equity, then they bought our real estate. And so what we're actually doing is we are selling our appreciating capital stock for depreciating imports. And this is cumulative. It's building up over time. So the U.S. has the deepest negative net international investment position in the world. And this can go on for quite a while. I mean, it's gone on for 5 decades. But it's getting closer and closer to a breaking point. And that manifests in different ways. How often the Federal Reserve has to intervene in the treasury market, for example. Rising populism, not just in the U.S., but also Europe and certain developing countries, as there's imbalances that people are on different sides of that they're all getting frustrated by. Another way to measure instability in Europe, so you basically they have a monetary union without a fiscal union. And over time, you've got kind of increasing anti-EU sentiment in certain countries. And generally, every kind of election cycle, some of the more populist candidates get a little bit more traction than the prior cycle. And I mean, I think eventually, probably it only takes one or two key elections to then really shift things. Like once Brexit happened, I know that's not part of the Eurozone, but basically once Brexit happened, it only had to happen once. And imagine something like that happens in a Eurozone country like France or Italy. And if it only takes one of these big populist waves to hit a majority, and then it threatens the dissolution of, you know, the EU or the Eurozone, from one of the, you know, the top five kind of currency countries in it. So these are rising instabilities, and even just public debt itself, public debt as a percentage of GDP is another part of the kind of rising debt instability. So it's not as though the current system is just this stable system that can last indefinitely. Instead, it's a semi-stable system that works well enough, but slowly keeps building up imbalances until it kind of all comes out at once. And this happens every couple generations.
Got it. I appreciate that. I am curious how you think about things like timing. Because clearly all of this sort of points towards, okay, well, at some point, the current system is unstable or ultimately unsustainable, right? You're kind of navigating slowly towards some kind of event or change. And I wrote a post that I called the Roman Empire Fallacy, where it's like, we all know like history, like we have different empires rising and falling. And so you can kind of see that pattern. And my take is that as a human being, you're kind of biased to assume that whatever large event is on the horizon, it's going to happen a little bit sooner than it may actually. Like, you're biased to think this is going to happen in my lifetime. I'm going to be part of the big drama, or my insight is going to lead to profits, right? I'm kind of biased to think that the timing is a little bit more beneficial to my own lifespan. So I'm curious how you think about timing and also like your research process, because there's so much noise and there's, frankly, macro, there's so many voices. There's it's a little bit noisy. So I'm curious how you think about assessing that and, you know, just, yeah, because these are like big trends. I'm like, I guess so. But like, if it's run for 5 decades, like, how am I to figure out timing?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I take a somewhat quantitative approach to that. And that's why, you know, I don't generally like it when I see a lot of macro research combined with heavy political bias. Because it starts to be like people start mixing what they want with what they expect. And so you really have to kind of separate what you think of the system versus just crunching the numbers. You know, and also you take into account real politics, you take into account the social issues that are happening. So for example, the rising polarism does have to be part of your analysis, but you should try to detach yourself from it and actually analyze, is this getting better? Is this worse? You know, and things like that. And so you end up having a more specific view. So for example, like my view on Japan's situation is different than the view on Europe, which is different than the view on China, which is different than the view on the US. And you have to really kind of avoid those either perma-bear or perma-bull sort of mindsets. History can be a useful guide as well. Basically, you know, say, okay, last time we went through a cycle like this, how long did it take to play out? What could have accelerated or decelerated it? And so I kind of go back to these other things and say, okay, how long did these things take? They generally took decades. It was like an unfolding process over time. And not everything is like a big Boolean outcome. Sometimes you get a partial changeover, right? So it's like, when did the UK pound sterling stop being the global reserve currency and the US dollar became, you know, there's a couple different points. You could say arguably since World War One that began happening. Probably the Bretton Woods agreements, like the major, you know, if you had to pick one date, that would be the date. Mm-hmm. But also some people go as late as the 1950s with the Suez crisis and say that was kind of the final nail in the coffin for this is now fully transitioned. And it's not like the UK pound hyperinflated and went away. It rose to prominence and then it diminished. And it was a multi-decade process. And so it is important to kind of take a conservative view about timing. And that's why I focus a lot more on direction than on timing. And I start building like if-else models. Like these are certain signposts that I'm looking for that would tell me where I am on the timing. And for the other than that, I'm mostly looking at direction. And we can look at things like, okay, what is the net international investment position as a percentage of GDP? How quickly is that kind of changing? So, you know, a decade and a half ago, the U.S. was at like negative 10% net international investment position relative to GDP. And now it's at something like negative 70%, right? So it's sort of entered that kind of less stability regime where it's kind of falling off more quickly. And so those are things that accelerate kind of catch my eye. But it really is about trying to map out things as quantitatively as possible.
Got it. That makes sense. And I'm always struck that we have a lot of history, but we don't have a lot of history of, I guess, modern financial markets. And I think that's an issue for stocks as well, right? We're kind of looking at 100 years plus or minus. And so this, the sample is actually, in my opinion, often a little very skewed to the experience of specifically the U.S. And I guess I'm curious, what do you think of the value of historical parallels? I think you've written about the 1940s. People point towards the 1970s. And obviously, each of these have very specific dynamics going on. So what's your take on trying to draw an inference from, you know, 1940s to today? Some things are similar, but overall, it was just a completely different world. How do you think about that?
So I think you have to study them because they really inform a view. So if it wasn't for my research of the 1930s and 40s, it would have tangibly affected my investing over the past few years. So seeing the parallels there helped me see strong similarities in the 2020s and to anticipate inflation in a way that, for example, in the 2010s, I was not really worried about CPI inflation. And so that reading of history was very helpful. When people think of inflation, their knee-jerk reaction is to think of the 70s. And that's even though it's far back, it's still recency bias because that's the most recent significant inflation in the U.S. And people then think, okay, here's certain tools to deal with it. Whereas what you actually find is that the types of inflation here are totally opposite from the 70s. They're actually more like the 40s, and they had a very different playbook for handling it. And so if someone's not familiar with all the major inflation cycles, so the 1910s, which is mostly World War I, 1940s, 1970s, and then the 2020s, if you're not familiar with all of them, you're prone to just like, you know, it's not a big sample to begin with, but if you only go back to the most recent one, then your sample is terrible. It's just one. So it's important to know the difference, for example, in this context between lending-driven inflation, fiscal-driven inflation, low public debt environments versus high public debt environments, and how some of the tools can backfire and they can work well in one environment and backfire in another environment. So if someone can't map out that, then that's worth going back and studying all these periods to like if none of that made sense to the reader, I would say that's what you want to go check out. And you could see some of my work on that, fiscal dominance versus monetary dominance. That's where historical frameworks are helpful. But then to your point, there are always differences. So for example, I've compared the U.S. in the 2020s to the U.S. 1940s in terms of similar macro and fiscal environments. But for example, a key difference is that back then, the U.S. was the rising power, trade surplus power. Now, if anything, the U.S. is more like the U.K. was in the 1940s, the incumbent trade deficit power. So that's number one. Number two is back in the 1940s, the U.S. had kind of peak like anti-polarization, so peak coordination. So FDR had like 70% of Congress on his side, so supermajority. And of course, that had pros and cons. There's a national togetherness, you know, we're all in this together. We're going to buy the war bonds and, you know, like Rosie the Riveter. And like there's all this kind of like a very strong social cohesion. But at the same time, that's how you pass draconian things like banning gold ownership, or they actually put a lot of pressure. They kind of infringed on First Amendment rights during that period. They kind of said like these are certain things the journalists can't really criticize. We had camps for Japanese people. Just like there were all these human rights issues that happened because when you have a supermajority, you can just kind of go through everything. Like normal rules of law get cast aside. And so a more polarized environment is both good and bad. And one of the areas where it's good is it makes it harder to do sweeping things. So people say, well, why can't they just ban Bitcoin like they ban gold? It's like, well, technically they could, but we're not in the, like, you know, there's a lot of Congress people that like Bitcoin, for example. It's not, there's no 70% monolith there. And then going back to that other technical point, in the 1940s, when they basically inflated away a lot of these sovereign debts, they used a lot of capital controls. And that's also what I referenced before about training wheels on the Bretton Woods system. So the first half of it was, it had training wheels on it because they still had a lot of firm capital controls in place. And in a world of Bitcoin and stable coins and things like that, it's just way harder, right? So if you think of how do you bring money in or out of a country, there's really two main ways. One is physical ports of entry. So bring cash or gold through an airport, obviously very limited. Two would be wire transfers and any sort of fintech that, that runs over wire transfers, but that's also tightly controlled by government. Whereas, you know, like if I want to pay a Nigerian graphic designer, you know, we could be on a video call like this and she can hold up a QR code and I can pay her in whatever money she prefers. And it goes around her banking system. It can be Bitcoin, it could be stable coins, it could be gold, it could be gold backed stable coins. It could be whatever she wants. And I can pay that to her. As long as she has internet, you know, an email, a DM, a video call, I can pay her around her system. And also I could memorize 12 words. And if I had it, I could bring $1 billion through an airport. And no one can prove or not prove that I have that. It's infinite value density because you can memorize a private key. You can write down 12 words in your luggage. Like there's, you know, there's multiple, you can put it in, you can, you know, kind of put in a password protected file in the cloud for 2 days and, you know, access it when you can reconstitute your ability to access your Bitcoin in another country. So all these things, all these like normal capital controls that existed in the prior technology set are now kind of more highly porous. And so that's another, that's a key difference going forward. So that's a very long way of answering and saying basically that the historical analogs are important because you have to know the differences between different types of environments. And they help you understand what are, for example, what are the levers of inflation or disinflation? What are the levers? What normally do governments do when they have very high public debts? And then also, how can it be different this time because things are different?
Yeah, thanks. That makes sense. It's I don't think I have the constitution to, you know, compress $1 billion and put it on a USB stick, but it's definitely better than. I guess there's always these stories like, you know, during World War II, people trying to, you know, valuables like diamonds or whatever, like that's always been an issue. But I'm curious how you think about if people jump perhaps incorrectly to things, to something like the 1970s. Do you think that means there's kind of misperceptions or mistakes even on the, you know, kind of from policymakers or from the market or investors where people kind of misunderstand what's going on or have the wrong expectations or try to, you know, address the issue in the wrong way? Like, is that your take?
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, a key thing is that interest rates are a more mixed tool for dealing with this type of inflation than the 70s inflation. So if you have, and so there's two main types of money creation. One is fractional reserve bank lending. So banks make more loans, or the government runs very large fiscal deficits that are then partially monetized by the central bank. And so in the 1940s and the 2020s, the majority of money creation was from fiscal deficits, not from very high levels of bank lending. In the 1970s, although you did have fiscal deficits, the majority of money creation was from bank lending. And a lot of that was because the baby boomer generation, which was born starting in the late 40s, was entering their home buying years, which is peak credit formation. So, you know, mortgages, basically. And so you had a demographics bulge. And then, of course, you ran into real world constraints like energy constraints. So U.S. oil production went up for like 100 years straight and then peaked in 1970. And so we became more reliant on imports from OPEC. And then we had a multi-decade period of falling oil production all the way up until shale in the 2000s. And so that was the issue back then. And so in that kind of environment, so in the 1970s, when you have low public debt relative to GDP, and most of the money creation is from bank lending, interest rates are a very effective tool to control that, because you jack up interest rates, it slows down bank lending. And then, although it does worsen the public deficit, it doesn't do it too much because it's a small debt to GDP ratio. On the other hand, if you fast forward, and instead of having 30% debt to GDP, you have 130% debt to GDP, and in an environment where most of the money creation is coming from the fiscal deficits anyway, if you raise interest rates, it does put downward pressure on private sector lending, but then it actually blows out the public deficits with interest expense even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a very mixed environment where it's hard to actually slow down that process. And it becomes more like, instead of kind of permanently fixing the problem, it's more like holding a beach ball underwater, and it seems like it's working, but as soon as you try to normalize, it risks coming back because it's a fundamentally different reason. It's from the public sector in large part, from built up instabilities. And so that's something where understanding the 1940s dynamic is helpful, and thinking that things just play out like the 1970s, you'll be surprised and kind of caught off guard by certain things, I think.
Got it. So what to you are the lessons of the 40s from an investor standpoint? I mean, you didn't focus on that in the book, and I know you write a lot and about it. I'd love to kind of dig into that, because that was in the back of my mind. I was like, okay. For example, one thing that I think you did a great job at outlining is, if you're operating within the system, and like you explained things like the Cantillon effect, where it was like, okay, if you're part of the system, what are the smart or the obvious things to do, or that the system kind of incentivizes to do, like using leverage and kind of closer to the point of credit or money creation. So, but now that's a little bit less clear, right? Because interest rates have gone up and you're kind of maybe in a less stable period. So what do you think is the obvious, I don't know, takeaways, but like, how does this affect like an investor's thinking?
So I think one big lesson from that whole period was that debt bubbles, like major debt bubbles, tend to come in two waves. So in the 1930s, you had the popping of a private debt bubble, which is disinflationary. And then that causes more and more pain, more and more populism. And eventually there's more policymaker reactions, and a lot of that leverage gets pushed up to the sovereign level. And then it can also cause conflict, right? So that whole period, you know, kind of the war period, the Great Depression period, that eventually fed into World War II. And that's, you know, they then went to this whole kind of just massive fiscal deficit spending, inflationary policy. And so what we're seeing so far playing out is that the 2010s had a lot of similarities to 1930s, in the sense that we had a popping private debt bubble, which was disinflationary. But that now we're entering more of a public debt bubble, which tends to be more inflationary. And I have been saying this since 2019, 2020. And so QE alone is not really inflationary. It's just kind of like anti-deflationary. And so a mistake a lot of people made is that when they saw QE happening in 2020, they were like, oh no, we've seen this playbook. This is like 2008. Whereas I was like, no, this is monetized fiscal spending. This is not just base money going up. This is broad money supply going up. This is more like the 1940s now. This is actually inflationary. And so one was useful for predicting that. Going forward, now we're in a little bit new environment, because so far another thing that's deviated from the 40s is that in the 40s, in order to inflate the sovereign debt away, they capped yields at 2.5%. Even as inflation ran 6% on average for the decade and peaked as high as 19%. Whereas here, they're still trying to fight back with much higher positive real rates, which has mixed results. It does slow down private sector lending, but then it blows out the fiscal deficit even more. So it is somewhat of a different environment. One thing is looking at how different asset classes performed back then. So equities were mixed. But that was, you know, it was a different environment because you had a world war going on. They bottomed generally around Midway, Battle of Midway, and then kind of started going up from there as the war effort was looking more positive. Real estate was really interesting because, you know, when all that monetization happened, real estate prices just shot up and then just stayed at that higher plateau for like a decade. And I've generally been taking a similar approach with the current nationwide real estate market. So obviously cities are going to be different, but in aggregate, I think we're in a higher plateau now where prices kind of permanently readjust higher because of more money in the system. But then going forward, they don't, you know, they kind of just stagnate for a period of time. And just the system kind of works into that over time. And so I've not been expecting either a booming real estate market or a big collapse in prices either, at least looking at kind of linear markets in the US, like outside of certain bubble cities. And so far that's been correct. We've seen kind of a choppy sideways stock market. We've seen a choppy sideways real estate market. You know, prices were falling, but then they rebounded. And, you know, back then in the 1940s, you know, gold, again, gold was legal to own, but commodities in general did well. And so it makes, you know, looking at the similar dynamics today, not again, not just going on the 40s, but okay, I see that what they did there. And then I look at, you know, commodity by commodity, what does supply and demand characteristic look like? And if we do get, for example, later in this decade, another wave of inflation, I would expect another sizable move in some of these commodity markets. So gold to new all-time highs, uptick in silver, uptick in copper, uptick in uranium, uptick in Bitcoin, you know, assets like that, I think should have a pretty good decade overall. And generally, I'm bullish on the whole kind of energy complex, you know, not necessarily in any sort of 6 month window, but for the decade, right. That kind of real world asset is useful.
Yeah. I loved your post. I think that was under the curve, kind of highlighting kind of that period of underinvestment, like both the degree and the length. And I'm not sure if you referenced it, but it reminded me kind of that capital cycle framework that I guess many investors use of trying to figure out where you are. And I'm curious in your own process, how granular do you get, right? Because you deal a lot with, I'm always curious with this with macro, because you only have so many hours in the day, right? Like how much is it worth digging into a specific market, a specific commodity versus, like, I don't know how people stay on top with everything that's happening with the Fed. And, you know, it seems to me the mental bandwidth that can be allocated just to like the broad macro questions can just kind of take over. So I'm curious how you navigate your own kind of attention and what seems important. And then how important is it, you know, if you like real assets, like how important is it to understand the specific supply demand balances in an individual commodity? Like that seems to be more granular.
So one thing I do is I try to identify strengths and weaknesses and then lean into my strengths and outsource my weaknesses. And so I focus a lot on money and energy. That's my background. It's my experience. I focus a lot on that, along with, you know, my reading of history and things like that. So for me, that's where I get more granular. And then as I kind of circle out to other things, I get less granular and I start instead focusing on experts that are really good in that subject. And I just kind of have a stream of a handful of different experts in different areas. So for example, I don't know anything about biotech. It's just not an area that I have any opinion on whatsoever. So instead I would follow a biotech expert. People ask me my thoughts on like the price of tin. And I'm like, I don't know. Right. So for me, it's energy, you know, it's oil, gas, uranium, copper, gold, silver. You know, I don't go into like other commodities too much, or just certain groupings. Like, okay, what do battery metals look like? What do hydrocarbons look like? I don't get too granular there. And I would instead, again, defer to, you know, resource experts. So for me, it's really kind of that money and energy. And what I generally find is that so finance tends to be very siloed. So you have macro people that never look at any individual company. You have individual company analysts that never look at macro. And there is some alpha to be had by being, for example, a macro person that then goes and actually looks at what is this energy company saying? What does their balance sheet look like? What are they talking about? Because that helps you, that feeds back up into your macro view. You're not just like in this kind of detached macro framework. And I generally find that some of the real world stuff is what catches finance people off guard. Like the realities of engineering, for example, or the supply chains can't just rearrange themselves overnight. that there's actually real world kind of expertise built up that makes it, you know, people say reshoring and it's like, well, you gotta like build up all that human capital that you've outsourced for decades. And that doesn't, you don't just flip a switch and bring all that back in 3 years, right? And so whether it's, or it's how long it takes to bring on new energy capex, how long does it take to bring on a new copper mine? How long does it take to build something in a difficult regulatory environment? Especially if we, you know, a lot of the engineers have gone to work at Wall Street and you can't even get the right technicians and engineers to build it anymore, right? And so that intersection of kind of that money, energy, engineering, that's where I get pretty granular. And then I outsource other areas to experts that I follow.
Got it. I think you mentioned in a post that, I forget the exact words, but you said like the only system that's as broken as money is energy. So I'm curious how, what does that mean to you? And is that something that you're more interested in, I guess, from macro geopolitical perspective, or does that directly tie into kind of your overall view on assets other than specifically energy? Like how important is that to, I guess, the rest of the system or the rest of asset classes? Or yeah,
so energy input costs are one of the biggest correlates with inflation broadly. So that's huge. It matters for geopolitics overall. So who is an oil exporter? Who's the oil importer? Who, if you are an oil importer, have you secured long-term contracts? Are you allied with oil exporters? So it both matters from an investing standpoint, like whether or not you want to own the industry, but then it affects bonds, it affects inflation, it affects you know, what countries' overall equity markets or currencies are likely to do well over a 10-year cycle, that kind of thing. And the challenge with energy, people take for granted in some sense, how fragile our energy system is. And so what I mean by that is, you know, I looked at, there's this chart of like all of our energy production and consumption. And it shows like, okay, biomass and coal and oil and gas and hydro and nuclear and then other renewables. And I looked at it and like, I looked where my dad was born. He was born in the late 1930s. He was elderly when I was born, but so he's kind of old enough to be my grandpa, but he's anyway. He was born like at such an early phase on that chart. It's like remarkable how much in one human lifetime our world's energy system has entirely changed. Back then it was like mostly biomass, some coal, and like oil was still this like sliver on this chart. And since then we've become a globally oil dependent economy. Natural gas has arisen, nuclear has arisen, we built a bunch of hydro. You know, we have this much more energy intensive world, and people kind of take for granted that trend is just going to continue, that we're just destined, or like we're just owed like ever more energy. But that's something that had to be like built and worked, and we've moved up the energy density stack. So when you go from biomass to coal to oil to gas to nuclear, you increase your energy density along the way. And the problem going forward is that, you know, nuclear for a variety of regulatory reasons has not really been aggressively pursued for a while. So we've kind of taken away our potentially most dense energy source. Hydro and geothermal are geographically limited. And so we've been kind of trying to put less energy dense things back into our system. So solar and wind. And it's somewhat, instead of just happening from the market forces themselves, like someone builds a new technology that's just better and then just starts proliferating. Instead, it's kind of been a series of political decisions, usually non-engineers making engineering decisions, and then you start getting issues. And so, for example, Germany is partially deindustrializing in some sense because of its energy policy. And so you can't be an industrial base of the world if you don't have access to inexpensive and reliable energy. And so we've seen, you know, more and more firms are moving out and you know, if they're doing anything energy intensive, they can go to China, they can go to these other places, and that affects an economy, and that affects the role of geopolitics. And so I think, you know, I get concerned about the prospect of an energy crisis in the, you know, over the next decade because of underinvestment in some of the most energy dense sources and misunderstandings of what certain technologies can do in certain timeframes. So what can solar, wind do what can electrical vehicles do? I think that basically it's just there's been too many non-engineers building timelines and frameworks and incentives that don't really map on to what the technology is capable of, or at least in a certain time frame. And so, and, you know, when people say, what could go wrong or right? There's a lot of, you know, sometimes I'll talk about inflation and people will say, oh, you're like a doomy person. And it's like, I'll say, no, I just got back from Egypt, which had 37% inflation. And life was, people were going to restaurants, people were driving, people were living their lives. You know, my little friend was asking me, like, she wanted me to watch the latest Disney movie with her. You know, it's just like, it's people are living their life. The only time you run into like absolutely serious catastrophes is either when you get social breakdown or food or energy crises that, or war, right? That's when things go completely off the rails. And so that's why I take energy security seriously, because if you don't want things to fall apart, you have to make sure that you're investing adequately in dense energy sources, and that this is, I think this is going to be an issue in the years ahead.
Yeah, I guess as a German, I'm acutely aware of the kind of strange, or I mean, it's a policy choice, but the strange dynamic how it's playing out now. And I'm wondering, some of these things, as an investor, to your point about people in the finance world sometimes being disconnected from the real world, and I guess the same thing happens to politicians. But you assume, oh, there's an issue. And the market, like the market shows me there's an issue, price of energy is going up, like this is just going to correct itself and quickly, right? And so it's, I think it can be confusing to see the gap open up and keep widening, like between what you think should occur and what actually happens. And even in this case, I'm kind of curious how you think about, if this is a tail concern, how would you hedge yourself against it? Because, you know, I'm thinking like Europe, for example, has now this history of, well, if an industry makes an excess profit, maybe we'll just tax that away. So maybe the answer of, oh, I'm going to invest in an oil and gas company, maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it is as straightforward as adjusting your asset allocation towards that, but maybe it's not. I'm curious how you think about these kind of tail scenarios and like the political component.
Yeah, so I do think that energy investing is a useful portfolio hedge going forward. So instead of, you know, the 40 years of stocks and bonds kind of like, you know, helping each other, I think generally, having energy exposure to offset your other assets that generally prefer disinflation is useful. But I think you have to be concerned about jurisdictional reliability for reasons you just said. So I think it's, one is you can mitigate that by having some degree of global diversification with that energy portfolio. Like if I was a European, I wouldn't just want to own European energy majors. I'd want to own US, Canadian, Australian, Brazilian, you know, whatever the case may be. I want to own like a globally diverse set of these things. There's also, you can also, for example, sometimes own the underlying commodity itself, which might not get caught up in certain jurisdictional right. issues. You can also own servicing companies. So for example, if there's a company that owns drill ships, right, you know, they might not get caught up in a windfall tax on an oil producer, even though they're benefiting from the next CapEx surge. So you can kind of diversify both your geographic exposure and your sub-industry exposure. So producer, underlying commodity, you know, servicing company, that can kind of mitigate the chance that you have a good investment thesis, but then it gets kind of yanked from you anyway. Another one would just be making sure you're in the right jurisdiction for your concerns, right? Mm. So if your own physical location is one of the things that you can at least somewhat control, especially if, you know, unfortunately, the wealthier you are, the more discretion you have on where you can be in the world. But, you know, basically, if that's an option to you, just making sure you're in a good jurisdiction, that you have good ties to your community, that's a type of hedge. Or like, you know, what kind of energy sources does your house have? What are your backups if this one energy source goes out, right? And so thinking a little bit more in terms of resiliency, I think we've had kind of 30, 40 years of, you know, no one's really thinking about resiliency. We're all thinking about efficiency. And these more inflationary cycles tend to be more about resiliency than inflationary, that resiliency than efficiency, right? So I think that now we're in the mindset of, What is your backup energy source? What if they run out of that product? Do you have a little bit of, you know, if companies are not having any sort of stockpile, does your home have a little bit of a stockpile, right? Do you have some degree of storage, redundancy, that kind of stuff, in addition to your portfolio decisions?
I always find these, it's funny because I can kind of nod and say like, yes, I guess, you know, all of this makes sense. And then the reality is like, I'm in New York City, I'm in an apartment, very limited. Like I feel like there's always the things that make sense on paper. And then it's kind of to implement any of it would be rises to like the level of an inconvenience. And to your point, I think we're used to like several decades of just like things being stable. And I'm referring mostly to, I guess, the Western world, but like being fairly stable and okay. And sort of everything that's like, you know, like, should I move to Colorado and like whatever, and like be off the grid? Like all of these things immediately seem like very extreme. I've been thinking a lot about, and your book is part of that, this kind of, but just kind of, how do you think about all the changes that you've never experienced that are just so radically different from like growing up in a society that's where inflation is low and everything's stable. And one thing you touched on is the idea, and I like this one too, the monetary premiums and kind of scarce versus semi-scarce versus non-scarce assets and the kind of real estate you pick, or what things get substituted as an kind of an inflation hedge. And you're like, okay, maybe large companies have a built-in premium at some point if everybody saves in SPY. And obviously that kind of stuff can reverse too. So tell me about how you think about that in your own framework, you know, scarcity and monetary premiums, and how that can maybe also change as the macro changes.
Yeah, it's a good question. And to touch on the prior point, to kind of wrap that up, I mean, one lens that I have is that my husband and I have a household in the US and another household in Egypt. And so we're operating in two different environments. And mm-hmm. and so I tend to take an approach of what I consider realistic optimism, right? So you have to fade the doomers, right? Because that's how you lose. If you're a doomer, if you're a perma bear, that's how you lose money. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you can't be complacent and say, okay, this like unprecedented era of peace for 30 years is just how things are now, right? And so it's important to, like, you know, like if you have a grandma that like had certain, like she was a hoarder or something like that, there's a reason for it because she lived through some unpleasant times, right? And so that people then develop that urge, and we've kind of developed the opposite urge of like, we don't have to hoard anything. Any service we want, we'll just get. And what, you know, and that's, you know, the pandemic shook some of that, and inflation shook some of that. And now there's, you know, the energy crisis in Europe shook some of that. And I think that these events are to varying degrees going to keep happening, you know, hopefully smaller, but, you know, just that, I think basically we're entering an environment where you just can't take that 30-year period of how the world works at face value. So it doesn't mean not like get out of the cities, but it's like, okay, if you had to leave a city, where would you go? Right. Or if someone's looking to buy a home and you think, should I be a city liver? Should I be a suburb liver? Should I, you know, there's just different considerations you make around the margins that I think are useful. For the topic of scarcity, one of the things I covered in the book was inflation often gets people have different definitions of what inflation even is. And so I try to break that down and just say, okay, inflation's a spectrum. And here's what I mean. So if you look at a typical economy, and I use the United States just because the data and the continuity is good, but actually, like England and Sweden have really good data too. That's the US, England, and Sweden are some of the best data sets. But anyway, if you look at the US, you know, you'll have over a, say, a century long period, you'll have an average of, call it 7% broad money supply growth, right? So that's the unit of account that we are using as our money. And you'll see generally that truly scarce things like waterfront property or Van Gogh paintings, things like that, they will, over the long arc of time, generally appreciate somewhere in line with the money supply growth. And it's because they're, you know, you're increasing the number of money units. These other things are fixed, and they're basically just keeping up with the broad money supply. There could be bubbles, there could be recessions, but that's a general trend. Then you get into things that we get marginally better at making. So for example, the median house, a barrel of oil, an ounce of gold, beef, you know, raising cows and grass-fed beef, you know, these things tend to grow faster than CPI in price over the long arc of time. You know, they have more cycles to them, but over the long arc of time, but not as fast as broad money supply growth. And that's because they're not completely finite. We can make more of them. They're just either more energy intensive, labor intensive, something like that. Then there's CPI, which is generally lower than those things. And then there's the long tail of very deflationary, disinflationary things, which is what helps drag CPI down. And so things like software, electronics, textiles, grains, things that are just, you know, we've either mechanized or digitized or offshored, we get exponentially better at making these things. And, you know, for example, the cost of a gigabyte of storage goes down 1,000-fold. So we use 1,000 times more of it. And that's one of the factors that goes into CPI, right? So, or for example, it used to cost something to take a picture, and now, you know, one phone just replaces multiple devices, you know, paper, film, calendars, like all sorts of durable and consumable items just get kind of folded into the phone and made way cheaper. And that's very disinflationary. And so inflation is this spectrum, and CPI should not really be your basket that you're trying to keep up with. If you're an investor, or if you're trying to really keep up, generally, you know, like something like the American Dream basket, right? So single family home with a yard, good healthcare, nutritious dense food, you know, that basket of stuff is generally going up at a higher rate than CPI over the long term, even though it's not quite as going up as quickly as M2, because we are getting, our technology makes us marginally better at producing that lifestyle. And so that's something that just gets disguised, especially if you're a cash holder or a bond holder. If you're comparing yourself to CPI, it's like, okay, you're going to, you know, the long arc of things like pictures or, you know, plastic toys are going to get way cheaper for you. But those scarcer things are going to keep running away from you, generally speaking. And that's something that's just, it's very opaque to people. So something I try to address in the book.
Yeah, I thought you did an excellent job in the book on specifically that issue, because I think that is that a lot of things get conflated in the term inflation. Lynn, this was fantastic. I'm going to link to a few of your pieces. Really love your work and so much appreciate that you're sharing your thoughts and your time.
Happy, come on. Thank you for having me.